Hi, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the Austrian Circle. This is the program where we talk about the economics of freedom here on WHUS Stores 91.7 FM. So thank you very much for tuning into my show this morning. I am your host, Racker, and we are going to be discussing secession on the show today. Very recently, Scotland voted to potentially secede from the United Kingdom over in Europe, and this has been encouraging a lot of people in Europe to vote against their particular political standing in the territory that they live in. The Catalans in Spain are also wishing to vote for secession, to secede and start their own nation. The Venetians in Venice, in Italy, also want to secede from Italy and start their own nation in their particular territory. And really, when we think about this, it's really not much different from any other union that people get into and then decide that they want to dissolve. So if you're in a contract with an insurance company, then you would want to dissolve that relationship at some point if you are no longer satisfied with their services, if the prices are too high, or, you know, for whatever other reason, you would want to secede. You would want to get away from that relationship and start a relationship with maybe a different insurance company. And in this way, secession is not very much different from the dissolution of a marital relationship through a divorce. When people get married, you know, sometimes they can't foresee how the other party is going to act in the future. And for all sorts of different reasons, people decide that they no longer want to continue with that arrangement and they want to cancel and nullify that contract and move on to other portions of their life. And again, this is very similar to what people who want to secede are saying. They're saying this particular political arrangement no longer suits us, and we would like to arrange for different situations here in this area, and we no longer want to be under your political rule. And this is exactly what happened in the early American Revolution. The Americans seceded from Britain. That's what the Declaration of Independence was saying. They were saying, we no longer want to be under your political rule. We're going to start our own thing over here. You can have your thing over there. And we're just going to go on not under your rule, rather under our own organization that we have decided to create. And so secession is not a scary thing. It's not something that's something that should be feared. It's actually how we created this country, this grand and wonderful and freedom-oriented place. We seceded from a political entity that we no longer felt was serving us. And so with this in mind, looking at the Scotland secession, we see a very stark contrast between what happens now and what happened back in the day. So, you know, 1776, we signed the Declaration of Independence, and Britain sent an army over to squash the rebellion. So King George at the time did not like that people were going to secede from his rule. He wanted his taxes. He wanted to be able to control the colonies. He wanted all the money from the economic trades that were happening at the time. And so he sent an army to stop the secession movement. If we fast forward to the 1860s, we see the same exact thing. Lincoln wanted his taxes from the southern states, and he was not going to let them become their own nation because that would allow them to perform trades with Britain without getting the tariff money that he so desired. And so he sent an army to attack and kill and maim the people who wanted to secede, who wanted to leave his political rule. But now, if we fast forward to today, we see such a stark contrast between these two major examples of secession movements. We see in the Scotland referendum that people can actually sit down and decide and vote upon whether or not they want to secede from a political union without all the armies and killing and guns and murder rampages that go on in most secession movements throughout history. So this is great progress. This is fantastic that we can sit down as a civilized society and decide whether or not we want to be part of a union. This is what happened in marriage. Remember when marriage was this organization that you could not leave, and all the abuses and exploitation that came out of that, where the husband would get whatever he wanted, the wife just had to be submissive to whatever his needs were, and you know, he would become very aggressive again in the same way that states tend to brutalize civilizations that decide that they want to secede from that particular state. The husband would be a brutalizer of the woman in these early kind of marital relationships, even so, you know, recently as the early 1900s. So again, what great progress we are making towards civilization where we can consider dissolving unions without using force and attacking anybody who wishes to leave that union. You know, if somebody doesn't want to be friends with me anymore, I don't say, ah, well, I'm just going to send some armies over your way and just make sure that you continue to be my friend. No, I just say, well, if you don't want to be my friend anymore, I wish you the best of luck with your life, and I wish you well, but I'm going to not, you know, use aggression to make you stay in this union with me. And so the first article I'd like to read for you today is by Ron Paul. He's talking a little bit about secession and its historical context and in regards to the Scottish referendum. So Ron Paul has this article, Scottish Referendum Gives Reason to Be Hopeful. Even though it ultimately failed at the ballot box, the recent campaign for Scottish independence should cheer supporters of the numerous secession movements springing up around the globe. In the weeks leading up to the referendum, it appeared that the people of Scotland were poised to vote to secede from the United Kingdom. Defeating the referendum required British political elites to co-opt secession forces by promising greater self-rule for Scotland, as well as launching a massive campaign to convince the Scots that secession would plunge them into economic depression. The people of Scotland were even warned that secession would damage the international market for one of Scotland's main exports, whiskey. Considering the lengths to which opponents went to discredit secession, it is amazing that almost 45% of the Scottish people still voted in favor of it. The Scottish referendum result has done little to discourage other secessionist movements spreading across Europe in countries ranging from Norway to Italy. Just days after the Scottish referendum, the people of Catalonia voted to hold their own referendum measuring popular support for secession from Spain. Support for secession is also growing in America. According to a recent poll, 1 in 4 Americans would support their state seceding from the federal government. Movements and organizations advocating that state governments secede from the federal government, that local governments secede from state governments, or that local governments secede from both the federal and state governments are springing up around the country. This year, over 1 million Californians signed a ballot access petition in support of splitting California into 6 states. While the proposal did not meet the requirements necessary to appear on the ballot, the effort to split California continues to gain support. Americans who embrace secession are acting in a grand American tradition. The Declaration of Independence was written to justify secession from Britain. Supporters of liberty should cheer the growth in support for secession, as it is the ultimate rejection of centralized government and the ideologies of Keynesianism, welfarism, and militarism. Widespread acceptance of the principle of peaceful secession and self-determination could resolve many ongoing conflicts. For instance, allowing the people of eastern Ukraine and western Ukraine to decide for themselves whether to split into 2 separate nations may be the only way to resolve their differences. The possibility that people will break away from an oppressive government is one of the most effective checks on the growth of government. It is no coincidence that the transformation of America from a limited republic to a monolithic welfare warfare state coincided with the discrediting of secession as an appropriate response to excessive government. Devolving government into smaller unions promotes economic growth. The smaller the size of government, the less power it has to hobble free enterprise with taxes and regulations. Just because people do not wish to live under the same government does not mean they are unwilling or unable to engage in mutually beneficial trade. By eliminating political conflicts, secession could actually make people more interested in trading with each other. Decentralizing government power would thus promote true free trade as opposed to managed trade, controlled by bureaucrats, politicians, and special interests. Devolution of power to smaller levels of government should also make it easier for individuals to use a currency of their choice, instead of a currency favored by central bankers and politicians. The growth of support for secession should cheer all supporters of freedom, as devolving power to smaller units of government is one of the best ways to guarantee peace, property, and liberty, and even cheap whiskey. That article is by Ron Paul. You can read it online at lourockwell.com. It is called The Scottish Referendum Gives Reasons to Be Hopeful. The next article I would like to read is just a little bit about the Catalonian movement for secession over in Spain. Police clashed with thousands of Catalan demonstrators as they hit the streets of Barcelona and Madrid on Tuesday, outraged at the Spanish Constitutional Court's decision to suspend Catalonia's November vote for independence. The independence referendum, planned by Catalonia's president for this November, was unanimously suspended by 12 judges of the Spanish Constitutional Court on Monday. Angered by this decision, protesters took to the streets of Barcelona and several other cities, promising they are ready to begin, quote, the most powerful political campaign in European history, in case the referendum is not held, according to RIA Novesti, citing protest organizers. Despite Madrid's position that there is no way the government will allow the country to be split, Catalans remain adamant that they should be given a chance to vote. In response to the Monday decision, the Speaker of the Regional Parliament, Núria de Gispert, called for Constitutional Court to, quote, immediately lift the suspension of the referendum. Catalan separatist politicians also did not give up hope of a referendum. Quote, not rain, nor snow, nor any court will stop us, AFP quoted the leader of the Catalan National Assembly, Carme Forcadell, as saying at a Barcelona protest. Quote, on November 9th, we will vote and we will win. The Catalan government's spokesman, Francesc Homs, indicated that, quote, nothing has ended and the government is determined to move forward. We can't give the signal that we have given up. On Saturday, the president of Catalonia, Artur Mas, has signed a decree calling an independence referendum for November. His decision came after the regional parliament in Catalonia voted by 106-28 in favor of granting the president the power to hold the referendum. Speaking in a televised address after an emergency cabinet meeting Monday, Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy said he regretted Mas's decision to call for separation from Spain. Quote, nobody and nothing will be allowed to break up Spain, the Prime Minister said. To resolve the issue, the conservative Spanish central government filed two appeals, one against the law by the Catalonian parliament, allowing for the region's vote for independence, and the second one against the decree signed by the Catalonian president calling for independence. Now that the suspension of independence referendum has been approved, the court has 5 months in which to examine the matter. Catalonia is considered one of Spain's richest industrialized regions, with the population of 7.5 million people, about 16% of Spaniards. The region has its own language, culture, and is proud of its independent-minded citizens. Back in 2006, the region formally gained nation status. However, the claim was subsequently overruled by the Constitutional Court. And if you notice there, the Catalonians are quite rich, and that's a reason enough for the central state to want to maintain a hold on the taxation rights in that particular area. This is the same thing that Lincoln wanted over the South. He recognized that opening them up to being able to trade with Britain and the other European nations without tariffs and taxes being collected, in some cases over 50%, on the goods that were being imported, he knew that when the free trade was opened up that they would be intensely rich, and of course he wanted a piece of all of that money. So the next article I would like to read to you is by Karen Kwiatkowski, and it's called When Freedom Comes. Americans today owe modern Scots, indeed all Scots, an impossibly massive debt. What is it about windy mountains, rough seas, long summer nights, and green fields? What is it about liberty and self-ownership and, dare I say, rugged men in skirts that makes one's heart skip a beat? I doubt it is in the air or the water or the blood. A love of freedom, like love of family, is humanity 101. That great sage, Lady Gaga, would say, "We are born that way," and she would be right. The question is what we do about it, and what the young at heart Scots have done is magnificent. The Scottish vote count this past week is itself just a data point, and the more we look at what has been accomplished, the more we can celebrate where we are going in the liberty movement and actually getting there in our lifetimes. The fearful 50% accounting for vote fraud and the inevitable few who still believe everything they hear from official-looking men in suits on the set have spoken in Scotland. They are afraid of not being taken care of. Admitting this is the first step in their liberation from their psychosomatic disease. Naming the fear is simply huge, and now they have done it. This vote has started a new angle on the conversation between generations that has been going on in every Scottish household for a long time, in some cases for well over 300 years. The dependency-minded rallied in their fear and confessed a superficial loyalty to a distant and corrupt serfholder, superficial because all these fearful and aged Scots would ever do and can ever do for London is show up and vote. This is why the British High Command keeps insisting that the issue is now settled for all time. In their view, it better be finished, because the central state isn't yet ready to invade or to release the 4.6 million Scots to their own devices and monetary policy. Good to know, of course. I can imagine that the great-grandmothers who voted to stay in a corrupt government that fails to represent them for cash have one thing on their mind now: making peace with their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. This will entail family get-togethers in homes and pubs, phone calls, email and social media sharing, and open arms initiated very much by the winning side, the fearful ancients, and the just plain fearful. For them, there is time now and willingness to listen because it is now safe to listen. The impending threat of liberty has passed, if only for a moment. What will happen in Scotland, in fact what is already happening post-vote, may be Robert Higgs's ratcheting effect inverted. Higgs demonstrates without a doubt how the state uses and often designs and engineers security and societal crises to justify state growth, and once grown never shrinks, but rather holds those gains like a ratchet grips and locks in place. But ideas have their own kind of creative impact, don't they? And they come with their own protection and survivability. As we have all heard, ideas are bulletproof. Secession, liberty, smaller governments, independence from distant capitals with their warmongering and raw wastage. Scots can never go back to where they were in this conversation. No one can, and of course, who would want to? As the elderly and the frightened 20-somethings breathe a bit post-vote, their ongoing need for security actually drives them to listen to their children and their older siblings, and thus the arguments for an ostensible independence from a distant government to be traded for a more local one that already convinced nearly 50% of the living in Scotland will get repeated hearings across bars and kitchen tables. I suspect both sides will be genuinely interested in what their family members and neighbors have to say. I'd say more than a few conversions to independence will occur. We know that all eyes will be opened and sensitivities sharpened to every false move by the statists in Scotland and to every new betrayal by London. The frightened generations in Scotland and everywhere else are approaching a long and, I believe, very rewarding, teachable moment. At least 45% of Scotland will be taking advantage of this moment for months and years to come, making the whole world safe for decentralization, peace, and prosperity is a big job. It starts at home, and God bless the liberty-loving Scots once again for their heart, their courage, and their example. That article is by Karen Kwiatkowski, and it's posted on lourockwell.com. So the last article I'd like to read to you in the short amount of time we have left is by Ryan McMacken, and it is posted on Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org. And this is the five lessons learned from the Scottish referendum. Lesson 1. The global elites greatly fear secession and decentralization. Global elite institutions and individuals, including Goldman Sachs, Alan Greenspan, David Cameron, and several major banks, pulled out all the stops to sow fear about independence as much as possible. Global bankers vowed to punish Scotland, declaring they would move out of Scotland if independence were declared. The elite onslaught against secession employed at least two strategies. The first involved threats and for-your-own-good lectures. Things will, quote, not work out well for Scotland in case of secession, intoned Robert Zoellick of the World Bank. John McCain implied that Scottish independence would be good for the terrorists. The second strategy involved pleading and begging, which of course betrayed how truly fearful the West's ruling class is of secession. In addition to Cameron's histrionics and, based on nostalgia and maudlin, appeals to not break this family apart, Cameron attempted, apparently successfully, to bribe the Scottish voters with numerous promises of more money, more autonomy, and more power within the UK. The threats that focused on the future of the Scottish monetary system are particularly telling. The very last thing that governments in London, Brussels, or Washington, D.C. want to see is an established Western country secede from a monetary system and join another in an orderly fashion. Political secession is bad enough and is a thorn in the side of the EU, which clearly hopes to establish itself someday as a perpetual union with no escape option. A successful withdrawal from a major global currency, even to join the EMU later, would imply that countries have monetary options other than being absorbed wholesale and permanently by the EMU. Lesson 2. Secession movements will demand a vote. While the UK elites were desperate to see Scotland referendums fail, few argued that the Scots had no right to vote on the matter. Some argued that all of the UK should vote on it, but most observers appeared simply to accept that the Scots were entitled to vote by themselves on Scotland's status in the UK. This is bad news for many American and European regimes where traditions of democracy ostensibly run strong, but are manipulated to favor centralization. The United States government, for example, clings to the idea that no secession could possibly take place unless approved of by the central government, and most Americans will dutifully denounce any attempt at a secessionist vote as treason. But in Europe, the mere existence of the Scotland referendum calls into question the legitimacy of efforts by central governments to ignore or prohibit local votes on independence. The Italian government has practically refused to even acknowledge the existence of the Venetian referendum, and the Spanish government in Madrid has already reiterated that it will ignore the results of the upcoming Catalonian vote. It will not go unnoticed that the people who ignore such democratic outcomes when they endanger the elite's status quo are the same people who extol the virtues of democracy when it suits their centralizing purposes or when used to justify foreign wars. Those regimes that deny a vote or which refuse to recognize votes to secede will continue to appear more and more retrograde as time goes on, and much of this will be due to the nearly unchallenged Scottish prerogative to conduct local votes on secession. Some regimes may attempt to get around this by requiring nationwide votes on secession. Some observers have insisted that the relationship between such regions and the central governments in question are like marriages, and that secession is like a divorce. A much better analogy, of course, is of a battered spouse seeking to flee the relationship for a safe house. Giving the full national electorate a vote is like giving an abusive spouse the power to veto any attempt at divorce. It's interesting to note, however, that Scotland is not in the same position as Veneto or Catalonia, in that it is not a wealthy area of the United Kingdom. Indeed, from the point of view of budgets and tax revenue, England would not see much negative impact from Scotland's departure. Had things been different, we might not have seen the same accepting attitude toward a referendum. Nonetheless, the precedent has been set. Lesson 3. American ideas about secession are unsophisticated and parochial. For a great many Americans, the concept of secession is meaningless outside the context of the American Civil War, since it is conveniently never mentioned that the American Revolution was the result of American secession from the British Empire. Americans know virtually nothing of any other secession movement in history in any other context except the Confederacy and slavery. Some Americans of a certain age associate secession with the Yugoslav wars of the 1990s, wrongly thinking that war to be caused by secession and not by decades of centralizing communist rule. So most Americans, when faced with the question of secession, have only two responses. One, if you want secession, you must want Balkanization. By this, it is meant that secession equals ethnic cleansing or bloody civil war. Two, if you want secession, you must be racist, because, of course, secession could serve no possible purpose other than the spread of slavery. The Scottish question has made it clear that in the rest of the world, most educated human beings understand that secession has been used in a wide variety of historical and political contexts. Obviously, slavery has nothing at all to do with the secession movements in Quebec, Scotland, Veneto, or Catalonia. Moreover, Americans in the typical fashion of authoritarians, who justify any unjust state of affairs by dogmatically repeating the phrase, "It's the law," act as if the matter of regional autonomy and independence was settled once and for all in 1865 by the Civil War. Presumably, for these people, the matter has been settled until the end of time, because some other people, all of whom who are now long dead, fought a war about it. It requires truly awe-inspiring levels of Philistinism to think that something political is forever settled because of something someone else did a century and a half ago. Among more rational and reasonable groups of humans, however, it is recognized that political conditions and allegiances change constantly. At the same time, the pro-secessionists in America who dogmatically invoke the United States Constitution of 1787 as proof of secession's legality will continue to fail to win converts. The Constitution, as envisioned by those who wrote it, has been dead and buried for at least a century. The old interpretation is far too limiting in any case and only applies to full U.S. states and not to portions of states. Lesson 4. Secession is a good way to bargain. As we learned from the Scotland experience, centralizers fear secession to the point where they're willing to throw a lot of bones to the secessionists. Of course, in the case of Scotland, which is a net tax receiver region, these promises involved a lot of government welfare. In the case of Veneto, for example, things would be different. In any case, threatening secession is a useful tactic in obtaining additional autonomy. Ultimately, what really matters to the regime is the ability to inflate the money supply and control the financial system. Politicians from the central government will be willing to part with many powers, but the power to inflate and control the banks will never be given up lightly. Lesson 5. Centralization is unnecessary for economic success. And if you'd like to read the answer to that lesson and why economic success does not hinge on whether or not you have a large central state, you can read the article. It's by Ryan McMacken. It's called Five Lessons Learned from the Scottish Referendum Line at Mises.org. So thank you so much for listening to my show. This has been the Austrian Circle. I'll be back next week with another episode, and I hope that you have a great week yourself. Take care.